Brethren, as I just mentioned, you know, as we all know, the fall holy days are literally just days away from the time you're hearing this sermon. And one of the things that the Bible mentions several times is one of the purposes that God states for us as to why we keep the holy days is specifically that we may learn to fear God. And he tells us this is a requirement, you know, that we have to learn to fear him. And again, he specifically mentions that, you know, our keeping of the holy days, that one of the fundamental purposes of it is that we may learn to fear him always. So with the fall holy days coming up just around the corner here, I'd like to focus on this particular subject so we can go into this with an understanding of what the fear of God is all about, to understand what this means and how we should go about learning to fear him in the upcoming holy days here. So if you'd like a title for this sermon, it's Understanding the Fear of God. Again, Understanding the Fear of God. Because as I mentioned, this subject is very intimately tied to the holy days. If you'll turn with me over to Deuteronomy chapter 14, we can see this relationship here. It's Deuteronomy 14. We're going to cover the section here, just a few verses that are specifically in the context of second time. Because, yeah, as you know, one of the reasons, you know, the main reason that we, you know, did diligently save our second tithe all year is, again, specifically for the purposes of that being able to fund our attending the festivals and attending God's holy days. Well, let's notice what he mentions within this command. It's Deuteronomy 14 and verse 22. And you shall truly tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year. And you shall eat before Jehovah your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide, the tithe of your grain and of your new wine and your oil, of the firstlings of your herds and your flocks. Now notice the purpose, this last phrase, that you may learn to fear Jehovah your God always. In other words, one of the fundamental reasons why we save second tithe and we go to keep the holy days is, again, specifically that we may learn to fear God. So, going into the fall holy days here, this is something we need to focus on to understand, so we can fulfill one of the purposes of exactly why we're keeping the holy days. We need to be keeping these holy days with a focus on learning to fear God. You know, so I want to focus today on that subject so we have an understanding of what this means. But first of all, let's also notice another verse here in Deuteronomy 31. And again, specifically ties this subject to keeping the holy days. And in this case, specifically in the context of the Feast of Tabernacles here that we'll be keeping in just a couple of weeks from the time you're hearing this sermon. It's Deuteronomy 31 in verse 9. Again, Deuteronomy 31 in verse 9. So Moses wrote the law and delivered it to the priests and the sons of Levi. And he bore the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah and all the elders of Israel. And Moses commanded them, saying, at the end of every 7 years, at the appointed time in the year of release, at the Feast of Tabernacles, when all Israel comes to appear before Jehovah your God in the place which he chooses, you shall read this law before all of Israel in their gathering. Gather the people together, men and women, little ones, and the stranger who is within your gates, that they may hear, that they may hear, and they may learn to fear Jehovah your God, and carefully observe all the words of this law, and that their children who have not known it may hear and learn to fear Jehovah your God, as long as you live in the land in which you cross the Jordan to possess. Notice he commanded them to do this every 7 years at the Feast of Tabernacles. And again, to understand the context here, realize that at the time he's giving this instructions, everybody doesn't have a Bible. You know, they're not all walking around with their own printed copy or multiple copies of it and a phone in their pocket that has, you know, an online Bible program and a laptop with multiple translations and such. They didn't have all that available. You know, they all had to rely on scrolls. And because of just the lack of technology at the time, you know, everybody didn't have their own scroll and in their own ability to read the Bible whenever they wanted to. And this is one of the reasons why he commanded every 7 years, you know, read this so the people have heard this. But again, the process that was playing out here is not only, you know, keeping the festivals, but hearing his word expounded. And again, what was one of the purposes that they were to do with this? To learn to fear him, you know, to have that healthy respect for him and to learn to fear God. And we also need to realize that this isn't just something that's a good idea. You know, fearing God is not just something that's advisable and something that's helpful in our lives. It's absolutely something he requires of us. So let's turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 10. And we'll start reading in verse 12. And now, Israel, what does Jehovah your God require of you? In other words, this is required. But to fear Jehovah your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve Jehovah your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to keep the commandments of Jehovah and his statutes, which I command you today for your good. So see, it's not, again, just something advisable and something helpful for us to learn to fear him. It's an absolute requirement. It's something he demands of us that we have to learn to fear him. So again, to be in obedience with him and to keep the holy days as he has instructed us, we need to do so with a focus on learning to fear him. Because realize that not only is it something that he would require of us, it's something that he will absolutely test us on, that he will orchestrate trials in our lives to see that we absolutely fear him. And a good example of this can be found in Genesis chapter 22. It's a famous story I think we're all probably familiar with. It describes a major trial that Abraham was put through here. So he was given the promise that, he would be the father of many nations and, lots would descend from him. That Christ would be one of his descendants and offer salvation to all of mankind. But all of this required him to have a son, so that he could carry on his lineage to fulfill all these promises. Well, he waits, for many years, waiting to be able to have a son, and for God to finally fulfill this. Well, he finally gives him Isaac. And after Isaac's born and finally grows up, then God gives him the ultimate test. He says, that son that you waited for all these years, take him to the mountain and kill him for me. As you can imagine, this had to be an absolutely gut-wrenching trial, for Abraham to go through. It's easy for us oftentimes when we read these stories in the Bible and we know how the story ends, we know who the hero is and all that. It's kind of academic for us. We can kind of look at this and kind of lose the reality of what this felt like for someone like him actually going through this. But this had to be absolutely gut-wrenching trial for him to go through. And as we all know from the story, but before he actually has to kill Isaac, God hasn't stopped and doesn't do this. But just notice that the comments that are made here that tells us kind of what this whole trial was about. It's Genesis 22 in verse 11. But the angel of Jehovah called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, Here I am. And he said, Do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him. For I now know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. In other words, after he successfully passed this trial, what did they say? Now we know you fear God. Obviously, that's what this was about. It was a test to see how well he feared him. And he put him through the ultimate gut-wrenching test, to show that he would put God first, even over his own son, even over suffering great loss, he would put him first. And this was evidence that he feared God. And that's why we need to understand how important this particular subject is. Now, to gain a little more understanding what the Bible is getting at when it's talking about fearing God, let me share with you the definition of the Hebrew word that's most often used when this particular subject is talked about. And again, it's not 100% of the time always this Hebrew word, but the Hebrew word here translated for fear, it's most often used in this context, again, is yare. It's transliterated as Y-A-R-E. It's Strong's number 3372. And according to the Complete Word Study Dictionary of the Old Testament by Warren Baker and Eugene Carpenter, it's defined as, quote, a verb meaning to fear, to respect, to reverence, to be afraid, to be awesome, to be feared, to make afraid, to frighten. The most common translations are to be afraid, to fear God. Now, one of the reasons why I read this is I think when we oftentimes think of the fear of God, we automatically think in terms of a reverence and a respect and an awe, of understanding who God is. And we think of it in that context, but oftentimes we think of it like, well, that would never include being, afraid of like bad things happening to you, and we kind of eliminate that concept and think, well, what couldn't mean that? Well, actually it does include, that concept. Now, again, just to show you some ways in which this word is used, and then I'll frame this in a minute, how to properly apply this to the fear of God. But just to give you a couple of examples of how this exact same Hebrew word is used, turn over to Genesis chapter 26. It's Genesis 26, and we're going to read from verse 7 here. Now, just to summarize the context here, this is where Isaac is dealing with Abimelech. You know, he kind of makes the same mistake his father did in denying that his wife is his wife, because, you know, he's afraid and he's acting like a coward. But let's notice here in Genesis 26 and verse 7. And the men of the place asked him about his wife, and he said, "She is my sister." For he was afraid to say, "She is my wife." Now, this is Yair. This is the same Hebrew word. "Because he thought, lest the men of the place should kill me for Rebekah, because she is beautiful to behold." So, see, now what he's afraid of, he doesn't have an awe and a respect and a love for these guys. He's just afraid they're going to kill him. You know, he's afraid they're going to be evil and bring calamity upon his life and kill him and hurt him, and he's terrified of it. And of course, I mean, he's acting like a coward. He's denying that his wife is his wife. But we understand that this concept can be included in the use of this word. Now, let's turn over to also to Genesis 32. We'll see another example of this. Genesis 32, and again, just to summarize the context here, we're going to read an account here of a story involving Jacob and Esau. And I'm sure a lot of you are already familiar with the context that leads up to this, that, you know, Esau is actually the firstborn, but Jacob winds up kind of conning, you know, Esau out of his birthright and receiving the blessings. Well, this creates some friction in the family. You know, this created some conflict between the siblings. And just to pick up here in Genesis 32 in verse 6, it says, "Then the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, 'We came to your brother Esau, and he also is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him.' So Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people that were with him, and the flocks and herds and the camels, into two companies. And he said, 'If Esau comes to one company and attacks it, then the other company which is left will escape.' And then Jacob said, 'O God of my father Abraham, O God of my father Isaac, Jehovah who said to me, "Return to your country and to your kindred, and I will dwell well with you. I am not worthy of the least of the mercies of all your truth which you have shown your servant. For I crossed over this Jordan with my staff, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, for the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and attack me and the mother with the children." And now notice here again, in both the references to fear and being afraid here, it's again the same Hebrew word. You know, and again, this isn't an awe and a respect, you know, for his brother that's being expressed here. It's a terror of, "I think he's going to come and try to kill me." You know, so he's afraid of calamity upon him. You know, it's kind of the same concept. You know, oftentimes when we think of fear, you know, in our day-to-day lives, you know, we may think of a scenario like, for example, maybe you're hiking in the woods, you know, or in a national park somewhere, and you happen to come across a grizzly bear. You know, and it's a mom of grizzly bear and has some cubs with her. Well, that the sight of that typically strikes fear and terror in us, because we're thinking, okay, the bear's there. I think I'm going to go in the other direction. I'm not going to hang around because I'm afraid she's going to kill me. You know, and that's how we think in terms of fear. You know, and again, the two examples that we just read, that's exactly, you know, what Isaac was experiencing, what Jacob was experiencing is a fear of, you know, this evil thing's about to kill me, and they're in terror. Now, even though the word, you know, year can again include this kind of a concept, we also need to understand in terms of applying this to God, it's certainly not the same thing of, here's someone who's going to try to do evil upon me, you know, who's going to try to evilly hurt me. That would certainly never apply to God. The way the concept we need to understand it in reference to God is more the concept of, yes, being afraid of consequences of our actions, of realizing that he has every right, you know, to bring upon us the natural consequences of our sins and to punish us for that and to bring his wrath upon us. You know, because again, it's only because of his mercy that he doesn't. And one of the aspects that we need to understand in terms of the fear of God is a healthy fear of, again, you know, potentially receiving his wrath or the consequences of our actions, which he can justly bring upon us because we deserve it. And again, this is part of the concept of fearing God, is again a healthy respect for this. And to understand this, turn over to Numbers chapter 12. Numbers chapter 12. What we're going to see here is the story where Miriam and Aaron are questioning Moses. And this starting in verse 1. And then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married, for he had married an Ethiopian woman. And they said, "Has Jehovah indeed spoken only through Moses? And has he not spoken through us also?" And Jehovah heard it. Now the man Moses was very humble, more than all the men who were on the face of the earth. And suddenly Jehovah said to Moses, "Aaron and Miriam, come out, you three, to the tabernacle of meeting." So the three came out. And then Jehovah came down in the pillar of cloud and stood in the door of the tabernacle and called Aaron and Miriam. And they both went forward. And then he said, "Hear now my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, Jehovah, make myself known to him in a vision, and I speak to him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. I speak with him face to face, even plainly and not in dark sayings. And he sees the form of Jehovah. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses?" I notice he's basically telling him, you know, why did the consequences of overstepping your boundaries, why did that not scare you? You know, that should have installed some fear in you, you know, simply for knowing you're overstepping your bounds and there can be some nasty consequences to this. You know, and to realize that's exactly what he's getting at, all we have to do is read the next two verses. In verse 9, "So the anger of Jehovah was aroused against them and he departed. And then the cloud departed from above the tabernacle. Suddenly Miriam became leprous as white as snow. And then Aaron turned toward Miriam, and there she was a leper." See, she's facing nasty consequences for her actions. And that's what he's basically saying, you know, this whole concept of, you know, you overstepping your bounds like that, that should have scared you. You know, you should have thought, you know, this could end very badly. I don't want to do this. You know, this is the concept of what he's getting across to her. Now, again, just to kind of cover a little, maybe a little bit of a tangent point here. If you're like myself, for much of my life, I would read this story, and you kind of wonder, okay, well, Miriam and Aaron are both guilty of questioning him. Why is it that Miriam gets the leprosy and Aaron doesn't? Well, here's just some food for thought in that regard. You know, I would say, and again, speculate that Miriam may have been more likely the ringleader in this. But also think of this in terms of who's overstepping their bounds, you know, more, more severely. Because think about the role that Moses and Aaron played in leading Israel. You know, yes, they're kind of in a, you might say, in the limelight. You know, they're giving out instructions and leading the people and kind of, you know, in that having authority, you know, in the spotlight role. Well, there was a negative side to that too. But because notice oftentimes whenever Israel got upset with what was happening, you know, what did they do? Let's pick up stones and let's stone Moses. And you'll find times they want to stone Aaron. And in all their anger, in all, you know, being upset about what's happening that they don't like, gets vented at them. What you see here is Miriam going, well, God works through me too. I want my say. I want to tell him how to do stuff. If you look back in the situations where the rest of the congregation is ready to stone Moses and Aaron, never once do you see Miriam going, well, God works through me too. You should want to throw thrones at me too. You know, you know, because what she wanted was having her say. She didn't necessarily want all the accountability that came with it. You know, and that's a package deal. And again, I would speculate that that's one of the reasons why she received the leprosy is because she's overstepping her bounds more severely, you know, in the role here. Because again, it's not just about having say, it's about having all the accountability. It's a package deal. You know, that comes together. But again, just to get back on track here in terms of the fear of God. Turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 9. We'll see another example here. Now, this is actually a different Hebrew word we're going to look at here, but I'll define it here in a moment. But I want you to see it again, the idea that the fear of God can very much include, again, a healthy fear of God's wrath and negative consequences coming to us. And again, it's not like God is, you know, it's just some tyrant who's going to mistreat us. It's simply he has the, you know, the full right and is very justified in bringing upon us the consequences of our sins. You know, and again, we should have a healthy fear of that. And again, this is Deuteronomy 9 and verse 15. And this is, Moses here is basically recounting the story of the golden calf incident, you know, that happened in Exodus. It says, "So I turned and came down from the mountain, and the mountain burned with fire, and the two tablets of the covenant were in my two hands. And I looked in there, and there, you who had sinned against Jehovah your God had made yourselves a molded calf, and you had turned aside quickly from the way in which Jehovah had commanded you. Then I took the two tablets and threw them out of my two hands and broke them before your eyes. And I fell down before Jehovah at the first 40 days and 40 nights. I neither ate bread nor drank water, because of all your sin which you have committed, doing wickedly in the sight of Jehovah to provoke him to anger. For I was afraid of the anger and hot displeasure with which Jehovah was angry with you to destroy you. But the Lord listened to me at that time also. And Jehovah was very angry with Aaron and would have destroyed him. So I prayed for Aaron also at the same time." Now notice what Moses is referring to, what he fears here, is again God destroying Israel. And again, it's not that God was some evil tyrant who was going to mistreat them. It's just they had totally disobeyed and abandoned everything they agreed to, and he had every right to punish them for that. But again, just to share with you the definition of the word here, because this is a little different Hebrew word used here in Deuteronomy 9. This is transliterated as Yagor. It's Y-A-G-O-R. It's Strong's 3025. And again, defined by the Complete Word Study Dictionary of the Old Testament by Warren Baker and Eugene Carpenter. It defines it as, quote, "a verb meaning to fear, to be afraid. In comparison to the more common verb for fear, yer, the verb we just talked about a minute ago, which often refers to a general sense of vulnerability, Yagor refers to fear of specific occurrences, such as catching a disease, being reproached or scorned, or being delivered into the power of specific people. It describes the fear of God in Deuteronomy 9:19, which focuses on the specific possibility of God destroying Israel." So again, we can see this is exactly, you know, something we should understand in regards to the fear of God, that it's not just this healthy respect and awe and reverence for God, which it certainly includes all of that. But again, I kind of emphasize this point because we oftentimes kind of miss, you know, the idea that it also means, again, a healthy fear for negative consequences and God's wrath that can come upon us because of our disobedience. But we also need to realize that again, as I mentioned, God's not a tyrant. You know, he's not someone we need to be afraid of, that he's going to be evil or mistreat us. We do need to be concerned about, again, the consequences of sin if we disobey him. But part of also understanding the fear of God and fearing him is understanding also his mercy and his love. So turn over to Psalms chapter 118. It's Psalms 118. And we'll start here in verse 1. It says, "Oh, give thanks to Jehovah, for he is good, because his mercy endures forever. Let Israel now say, his mercy endures forever. Let the house of Aaron now say, his mercy endures forever. Let those who fear Jehovah now say, his mercy endures forever. Notice, you know, that those who fear him, they're not trembling under, you know, the rule of a tyrant, you know, thinking he's going to mistreat us. No, they appreciate his mercy and his love. In verse 5, I called on Jehovah in distress, and Jehovah answered me and set me in a broad place. And Jehovah is on my side, I will not fear. What can man do to me? Again, we'll cover this a little bit later in the sermon, but you know, one of the things we need to realize in living our day-to-day lives is the greatest thing we have to really fear is not having God on our side. You know, but because if he's for us, then we don't need to fear evil from others. In verse 7, and Jehovah is for me among those who help me. Therefore, I shall see my desire of those who hate me. It is better to trust in Jehovah than to put confidence in man. It is better to trust in Jehovah than to put confidence in princes. Now, to see this a similar concept illustrated another place, turn over to Psalm 34. Again, we'll again see this emphasis of, you know, of his loving kindness and mercy. That fearing God, and again, having, you know, not only an awe and a respect for who he is and a reverence for him, but again, also a healthy fear of his wrath and disobeying him, doesn't mean that we need to tremble like he's going to be evil and mistreat us like a tyrant, because, you know, he's a very loving father. But again, in Psalm 36, in verse 1, I will bless Jehovah at all times. My praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul shall make it its boast in Jehovah. The humble shall hear of it and be glad. O magnify Jehovah with me, and let us exalt his name together. I sought Jehovah, and he heard me, and delivered me from all of my fears. And they looked to him who were radiant, and their faces were up in shame. And the poor man cried out, and the Lord and Jehovah heard him, and saved him out of his trouble. And the angel of Jehovah encamps around those who fear him and delivers them. In other words, those who fear him, he takes care of. You know, he delivers them, he will protect them. You know, so again, we need to have a healthy fear and respect of him. But if we're diligently obeying him and rely upon him, we don't need to fear others. We don't need to fear evil coming upon us, because he will be our protector. And we also need to realize that the fear of God is something we need to choose. It is literally something we need to actively pursue and to choose. And turn over to Proverbs chapter 1. Actually, but before going over to Proverbs, let's turn over to Proverbs chapter 8, because actually, let me go to 16. I'm jumping in my notes here, because the first thing we need to understand is that the fear of God motivates us to obey him and to flee away from evil and to want to faithfully obey him. So if you turn to Proverbs 16 and verse 6, it says, in mercy and truth, atonement is provided for iniquity, and by the fear of Jehovah, one departs from evil. You see, if we have this healthy respect for God, like not only a reverence and an honor for him as to who he is and to want to submit to him, but again, also a healthy fear of disobeying him and of facing the consequences in his wrath. You know, that will naturally motivate us to want to go away from evil, you know, to turn away from evil, because we look at that and go, oh, that's not going to end well. You know, that's a painful path. I think I want to avoid that. And I want to try to go the righteous way, because that just turns out better, you know, and that's going to naturally want to motivate us to that. Well, not only is it going to want to steer us away from fear, I mean, away from disobedience. But again, if we have that healthy respect for God, you know, then that's going to cause us to want to trust him and to want to be obedient, again, even when that is difficult and painful for our lives. And to see a good example of that, turn over to Hebrews chapter 11. It's Hebrews chapter 11. We'll look at the example of Noah here. It's Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 7. It says, by faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear. Notice godly fear was motivating his actions. Prepared an ark for saving of his household, and by which he condemned the world and became the heir of righteousness, which is according to faith. Now, as I mentioned earlier, you know, it can be easy for us today in our comfortable, you know, 21st century lives to be reading the Bible and some of these stories, and we look at it very academically, you know, because we kind of know how the story ends, we know who the heroes are, and everything turns out well. But we don't oftentimes put ourselves in the shoes of those who are going through it. Because imagine what it was like for Noah going through his day-to-day life. This is a guy for just decades, you know, year after year, is building this huge boat. You know, and you can imagine, just imagine how the neighbors would have, you know, have perceived him. You know, that crazy guy down the street, Noah, he's building this huge boat here. There's not any water around here to float that thing in. And he's always talking about calamity. All this big flood's going to come, and we're all going to get drowned. And this guy thinks that all these animals are just going to magically show up, and they're just going to volunteer to get on his boat, you know, and want to be part of this. That nut job, Noah, you know, that crazy conspiracy theorist, you know, can you believe that guy? You know, because I recently heard someone that kind of made a joke about this in a presentation that made me laugh. He said, Noah was a conspiracy theorist up until the day it started raining. Yeah, but because as you can imagine, you know, what the neighborhood and, you know, after all the years he's doing this, I'm sure the word got out far and wide, you know, about this crazy guy Noah building this big boat and talking about this big flood that's going to come. Well, the day it started raining, he wasn't so crazy anymore, you know, but he had to endure and to faithfully obey God through all of this, you know, not only just through his own human nature to keep, you know, steady with the course through all of this, but the ridicule and everything that he would have faced from those around him. And what motivated him to do this, again, was godly fear. It was his not only his awe and respect for God, but he trusted God. He knew there was really going to be a flood coming, you know, and knew that was going to happen. And if he didn't take action, he'd get drowned like everybody else, you know. So again, it was that combination of a respect for God and also, you know, a healthy fear of negative consequences. And if we have that same thing in our lives, it should motivate our day-to-day walk with God as well. Now, turn over to Hebrews chapter 12. And we'll see a comment here geared towards us. It's Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 28. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us have grace by which we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. Notice we should serve him with godly fear. And verse 29, for our God is a consuming fire. Notice it includes both concepts here. Again, it's not just the healthy respect and honor of God. Again, it's also a healthy fear of, again, his consequences. You know, that I mean, just like he puts before all of us. You know, when we're called into salvation, he sets before us life and death, blessing and cursing, urges us to choose life, tries to do everything possible to help us to choose life, you know, and to endure to the end. But if we insist on neglecting, you know, our salvation, not diligently doing what we should, or just turn our back upon him, he will let us choose death and he will kill us. You know, he will throw us in like a fire. You know, he makes that as a promise. And again, that's something we should have a healthy respect for as a part of our fear. Also realize if we have a healthy fear of him, and it not only will this motivate us to want to obey God, it will also motivate us to hate evil. You know, because oftentimes we think as Christians, well, we shouldn't hate anything. You know, we should always just be loving. I think, well, that's not true when it comes to evil. And it doesn't mean hating people who commit evil. It just means that we should have an absolute hate of evil. And the Bible tells us that directly. Turn over to Proverbs chapter 8. We're going to read verse 13. It says, the fear of Jehovah is to hate evil, Pride and arrogance in the evil way, and the perverse mouth I hate. Notice it defines the fear of Jehovah as hating evil. So if we want to have a proper relationship with him, and again, it's he absolutely requires of us that we hate, you know, that we fear him, then one of the things that we need to do is not just love God, we need to hate evil and actually be disgusted by it. Now, turn over to Psalms 36. See another verse that speaks to this concept. It's Psalms 36 and verse 1. An oracle within my heart concerning the transgression of the wicked. There is no fear of God before his eyes. And what we're going to see here is, you know, when they don't have any fear of God, they don't abhor evil, and they don't have wisdom. Because we're going to see that connection here in a minute as well. In verse 2, for he flatters himself in his own eyes, and when he finds out his iniquity, when he hates, and the words of his mouth are wickedness and deceit, and he has ceased to be wise and to do good. Because we're going to see here in a minute, there's a very strong connection between the fear of God and wisdom. In verse 4, he devises wickedness on his bed, and he sets himself in the way that is not good. He does not abhor evil. Notice those who don't fear God don't abhor evil. Because again, if we fear God, we're going to hate evil. It's going to be something that disgusts us, you know, and we're going to be just be repelled from it, you know, and want to turn away from it. And that's part of understanding the fear of God. And realize that this is something we have to choose. Turn over to Proverbs chapter 1. We're going to see here that the fear of God is literally something we have to choose and we have to pursue. It's Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 25. Because you disdained all my counsel and would have none of my reproof, I also will laugh at your calamity. I will mock when your terror comes. And when your terror comes like a storm and your destruction comes like a whirlwind, when distress and anguish come upon you, then they will call on me, but I will not answer. And they will seek me diligently, but they will not find me, because they hated knowledge. And notice the last verse here, a part of the verse here, and did not choose the fear of Jehovah. In other words, it's something we have to choose. We have to willfully pursue this. And they would have none of my counsel and despised all of my reproof. Therefore, they shall eat the fruit of their own way and be filled full of their own fancies. And turning away from the simple will slay them, and the complacency of fools will destroy them. But whoever listens to me will dwell safely and will be secure without fear of evil. See, if we choose the fear of God and we honor, respect him, we faithfully obey him. We do need to have a fear of negative consequences that come from disobeying him. But if we're honestly, you know, sincerely following him, and diligently seeking him in our lives, then we don't need to fear evil from others or other, you know, situations in our life, because we can trust in him to be our protector. You know, and I think a great example of this can be found in Daniel chapter 3. So turn over to Daniel chapter 3. It's a famous story here I'm sure we're probably all familiar with. The context here is, you know, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream earlier, and he saw this image, you know, and Daniel interprets it for him and, you know, tells him that, you know, part of it, he's this head of gold, and, you know, he kind of reveals to him these, you know, successive empires that will, you know, be reigning that part of the world for, you know, years to come. And as you can imagine, you know, after this, Nebuchadnezzar decides to put up this image and, you know, have, you know, whenever the music plays, everyone needs to bow down and worship it. Well, you can kind of connect the dots here to see the thought process of how he got here, you know, but because if he has this dream and sees this big image and is told he's connected with this, well, then later his ego likes this and he thinks, you know, I'm a big shot with this. Well, I'll build this big image and then tell everybody to bow down to it, you know, and this is essentially what he does. Well, you know, Nebuchadnezzar is kind of an egotistical tyrant in how he handles this. Because he makes an edict that everyone, whenever the music plays, everyone needs to bow down and worship this image. And it's not just a suggestion. You know, it's a demand, it's a threat. But because anyone who doesn't, you know, they're told if you don't bow down to this, if you don't serve this image, what's going to happen to you is you're going to get thrown in a fire and you're going to get brutally killed. Now you can imagine anyone living, you know, in this time, knowing his track record, realizes this isn't an empty threat. He will really do this. You know, he'll really kill us, you know, if we don't go along with this. So you can imagine the fear that people would feel with the idea of, man, if I don't go along with this, this guy's going to have me killed. I'm going to get burned to death. And you can imagine how that would frighten people. Well, as you know, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were some of the individuals, you know, that were forced with, you know, with this situation. You know, they're faced with this decision of, what are we going to do? Because if we obey God, we're likely to get killed. He's just going to throw us into a furnace. We're going to get burned alive. You know, and they're facing this decision. What do they do? Well, they set a very great example for us in how they handled it. Because they feared God and they understood, you know, that the greatest thing they had to fear in life was not having God on their side. You know, that as long as they were faithfully obeying Him, God would protect them. You know, one way or the other, it would still end well if they faithfully obeyed Him and they didn't give in and compromise, you know, to serve Nebuchadnezzar. And it all culminates here in Daniel chapter 3 and verse 16. It says, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from this burning fiery furnace, and He will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. In other words, they were saying, my God's able to protect me, but even if He lets me burn in the furnace, put it on the record, I still won't bow down to you. You know, I won't do it. You know, because again, the greatest thing they had to fear was disobeying God, was not having God on their side. That was the greatest thing that could go wrong. And they clearly understood this, you know. And as a result, I'm sure you know how the story ends. They do get thrown into a furnace, you know, but God protects them. And they later wind up coming out, you know, not even smelling of smoke and being, you know, it fringed by the fire at all. But the guys who threw them in there get killed, you know, because the heat was so great, because God protected them through it all. You know, and that's one of the things we have to realize in our lives, especially in the years ahead, is, you know, things get worse and worse in our nation. We need to realize that as long as we are putting our faith in God and we are diligently following Him, we don't need to fear the evil of the people around us. You know, what we need, the greatest fear we need to have, you know, is that God is not on our side. That's the thing we need to fear, because that's when calamity will come upon us. You know, as long as we are faithfully obeying Him, God will take care of us. And again, even like in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's situation, if He had allowed them to be burned up in the furnace, they'd still come up in the resurrection and they would still win. You know, so ultimately, again, as long as they feared God, you know, the greatest thing they have to fear is God not being on their side. Because as long as He's got your back, He's going to protect you through everything else. Now, the next thing we need to look at is the connection, as I mentioned earlier. There's a very strong correlation between wisdom and the fear of God. And I think sometimes we kind of underestimate this concept. Now, turn over to Psalm 111. I'm sure this is probably a memory scripture. I know it has been for me most of my life. Psalm 111 and verse 10. The fear of Jehovah is the beginning of wisdom. A good understanding have all they who do His commandments. His praise endures forever. Now again, if you're like me, that's a scripture you've probably been familiar with for many, many years, you know, and you're familiar with that concept. But I think sometimes we underestimate, you know, this concept and how much this can affect day-to-day life. And again, just having practical good sense, you know, in how we live our lives in the world around us. And to illustrate this principle, I'd like to read an article to you from Dennis Prager. You may or may not be familiar with Dennis Prager. He's got a regular, you know, a radio program he's had for years. If you've got a Facebook account, you've probably at one time or another seen a kind of a short video on various topics, you know, posted there. It'll be advertised as being from PragerU. You know, oftentimes they're like 5 or 6 minute videos just briefly covering, you know, various subjects. Well, Dennis Prager is the person behind PragerU or Prager University. And now he's Jewish, you know, he's not part of the Church of God or anything, but he is a very big believer in, you know, what is commonly referred to as Judeo-Christian values. In other words, just trying to live your life by the Ten Commandments, you know, by the basic principles laid out from the Bible. Dennis is a very big believer in that. You know, and again, everything I've seen about his life, you know, suggests he's very sincere about it. But he has an article on his website that I think just really speaks to this. It's not very long. I'm going to read you the whole article, but it really speaks to the meaning and the importance of this verse. Again, the article is entitled, How I Found God at Columbia. And again, this is from DennisPrager.com, and it was posted on December 2nd, 2003. It says, quote, very few people can say that they have found God or religion at college or graduate school. The university, after all, is a radically secular institution that either ignores or disparages religious belief in God. Yet one day when I was a graduate student in international affairs at Columbia University, I had what can honestly be called an epiphany. I remember it very clearly. Since entering graduate school, I was preoccupied with this question. Why did so many learned and intelligent professors believe so many foolish things? Why did so many people at my university believe nonsense such as Marxism? I was a fellow at the Russian Institute where I specialized in Soviet affairs and Marxism. And so I encountered professor after professor and student after student who truly believed in some variation of Marxism. Why did so many professors believe and teach the even more foolish notion that men and women are basically the same? At college, it was a given that the differing conduct of boys and girls and of men and women is a result of different, i.e. sexist upbringings. The feminist absurdity that girls do girl things because they are given dolls and tea sets, and boys do boy things because they are given trucks and toy guns, was actually believed in the mind-numbing world of academic intellectuals. And why were so many professors morally confused? How could people so learned in contemporary history morally equate the Soviet Union and the United States, regard America as responsible for the Cold War, or regard Israel as the Middle East's villain? One day I received an answer to these questions, seemingly out of nowhere. A biblical verse, one that I had cited every day in kindergarten at Jewish religious school I attended as a child, entered my mind. It was a verse from Psalm 111. Wisdom begins with the fear of God. The verse meant almost nothing to me as a child, both because I recited it in the original Hebrew, which at the time I barely understood, and because the concept was way beyond a child's mind to comprehend. But 15 years later, a verse I had rarely thought about answered my puzzle about my university and put me on a philosophical course for which I have never wavered. It could not be a coincidence that the most morally confused of society's mainstream institutions, the one possessing the least wisdom, the university, was also society's most secular institution. The psalmist was right. No God, no wisdom. Most people come to believe in God through what I call the front door of faith. Something leads them to believe in God. Since that day at Columbia, however, I regularly renew my faith through the back door. I see the confusion, nihilism that godless ideas produce, and my faith is restored. The consequences of secularism have been at least as powerful a force for faith in my life as religion. If our universities produced wise men and women, curricula of moral clarity, and professors who loved liberty and truth, not to mention loved America, there is no question that my religious faith would be challenged. I would look at the temple of secularism, the university, and see so much goodness and wisdom, I would have to wonder just how important God and religion were. But I look at the university and see truth deconstructed, beauty reviled, America loathed, good and evil inverted, elementary truths about life denied, and I realize one very powerful argument for God is that society cannot function successfully without reverence to him. So as much as I shudder almost every time I read another academic taking an absurd position, I also feel my faith renewed. Ironically, the worse the universities get, the greater their tribute to God. You know, every time I think of something like this, this article comes to mind. You know, about 30 years ago, I was in graduate school myself, and I can't say I had the same epiphany as Dennis, but I made a similar observation. You know, sitting through classes, watching people that, you know, had very high IQs, were obviously very educated in learning, and hearing absolute nonsense come out of their mouth. I mean, in ideas that you could easily prove through documentable history and facts and statistics to show this is just nonsense, you know, and seeing that they've clearly believed it, you know, and I would just kind of scratch my head. And every time I kind of scratch my head and wonder, okay, why is it people fall for this? Then as this article comes to mind, no God, no wisdom. You know, I even look at, you know, at how our country is going now in the last few years. You know, in looking at this and thinking, how can so many educated, intelligent people not see something's wrong? You know, and again, I come back to no God, no wisdom, because there is a huge correlation between the fear of God and wisdom. And again, the fear of God is actually the instruction in wisdom. Turn over to Proverbs 15 and verse 31. The ear that hears the reproof of life will abide among the wise. And he who disdains instruction despises his own soul, but he who heeds reproof gets understanding. The fear of Jehovah is the instruction of wisdom, and before honor is humility. Again, having just a basic fear in God, you know, gives people, again, even though it's not called, even individuals like Dennis, again, who's Jewish, he doesn't believe in Jesus Christ, he's obviously not being called, you know, to salvation at this time. But if you see much of his stuff, and again, just in terms of practical values, practical wisdom of life, I'm not endorsing his theology, you know, but you see just a lot of good, solid common sense, you know, and the reason being is, again, there's a respect there for God and for the Bible, that it is the source of wisdom, that the basic biblical principles are things of how we should structure our life and to live. And those who reject that, again, you just see massive foolishness, you know, from them, because, again, the fear of God is not only the beginning of wisdom, it is the instruction of wisdom. This is what we should turn to as his word, you know, to know how to live our lives. But again, we particularly as his called out people, need to be focusing on how to develop the fear of God in our lives. And again, particularly as we're, you know, moving here into the fall holy days, because again, as I mentioned, the holy days are specifically one of the specific reasons why God commands us to keep them, is so that we can learn to fear him. So what do we need to do to learn to fear God? How do we put that into action in our lives? Well, the answer for that is found in Proverbs chapter 2, in verse 1. My son, if you receive my words, treasure my commands within you, so that you incline your ears to wisdom and apply your heart to understanding. Yes, if you cry out for discernment, and lift up your voice for understanding. If you seek her as silver and search for her as hidden treasures, then you will understand the fear of Jehovah and find the knowledge of God. In other words, it's something we need to seek. As I mentioned earlier, it's something we have to choose. We have to make a conscious decision, you know, that we want to learn to fear God, and we want to incorporate that in our day-to-day lives. And as he said here, he goes, we need to search it out. We need to cry out for it. We need to put effort and energy into studying it. You know, that's one of the reasons why we need to have our faith in this book, you know, and regularly studying it so that we can receive the instruction in wisdom. You know, we can receive his instructions of how we should live our lives. And again, as we do that, and especially as we yield to those instructions, you know, and take correction from it and apply it in our lives, you know, then we're learning to fear him. And again, two things are happening with that. It's naturally going to make us want to repel away from evil. It's going to make us want to hate evil, you know, and have nothing to do with it. And it's going to make us want to lean to his way and again, to faithfully obey him, even again, if that's painful and difficult in our lives. Because again, you know, as we face difficult trials in our lives, and I'm sure as the years, you know, go forward here, we're going to face more and more. And we need to, you know, to learn from examples like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You know, when their lives are on the line, when your job is on the line, when your security is on the line, remember, you know, that the greatest thing you have to fear is again, not following God, not having Him on your side. If He is on your side, then He can deliver you through whatever trial you face. You know, and then we can look at those trials and say, oh, Nebuchadnezzar, I have no need to answer you in this matter. You know, my God is able to save me. And even if He doesn't, for the record, I still won't bow down to you. You know, and we need to realize that that's something that we can play out in our own lives if we learn to fear God. And again, to summarize the definition of that. Again, it's not just the awe and respect. Because it certainly includes that. You know, we oftentimes think of it in terms of the awe, the respect, the reverence for God, and that's absolutely part of the definition. You know, but it's also, again, a healthy respect for disobeying Him, you know, and the consequences of the wrath that could come with that. And if we have that healthy appreciation, we'll want to obey Him, you know, we'll want to get away from evil, and we'll want to trust in Him and follow Him. So as we know, brethren, in just a matter of days here, the fall holy days will be upon us. And one of the reasons that we keep these days is, again, specifically so that we can learn to fear God. So as we keep these days, let's keep a focus upon this so that we can learn to fear Jehovah our God always.